Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk by Lama Kathy Wesley is entitled, The Most Important Decision of Each Moment. Mindfulness meditation makes us more aware of our daily thoughts and patterns. This is both good, now we can see what once was hidden by our habitual thought patterns, but challenging in that now we must take responsibility for our thoughts, words, and actions. How do we use mindfulness's gifts to make the critical decisions that shape our life? This talk discusses the most important decision of each moment and how we train ourselves before we get to that decision point. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So today, I have a short talk to give. The most important decision of every moment has to do with the basics of Buddhist teaching, and it has to do with the practice, the basic Buddhist practice of mindfulness. Because knowing that there is a decision to be made in every moment, knowing that, is known by studying the basic teachings that the Buddha gave. The Buddha, an awakened being from 2,500 years ago, gave basic teachings on how each and every being can gradually attain the same state of Buddhahood that was attained by Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha himself. So it wasn't that the Buddha was some sort of freakish person who gained enlightenment and then there would be no more. It wasn't like that. The Buddha said, I have attained, and you can also. And so he gave the teachings for our benefit so that we could attain the same state of awakening, the same state of complete love, the same state of complete compassion, the same state of complete wisdom that he attained. So as a result of his instructions, we are now able to practice in this way. And when he gave his overview of the practice of Dharma, he spoke about the Four Noble Truths, that suffering was part of life, suffering had a cause, suffering had a solution, and there was a path that led to the cessation of suffering. And when he gave his teaching on the Second Noble Truth, that there is a cause to suffering, he didn't see the causes of suffering as being external. We who live our daily lives in this kind of flawed and amazing world, sometimes we make the mistake of thinking that the causes of suffering are external. It's the boss, or it's society, or it's that person that I chose to live with, or it's... or it's my family, or it's whatever, whatever, whatever. We tend to see the causes of suffering as being external to us. But the Buddha's teaching was different. He invited us to look inside and see how our own habits and attitudes contribute to the experience of suffering. He basically said, if you want to see the causes of happiness and you want to see the causes of suffering, look inside, look within. And that was what he gave us as a teaching in his Second Noble Truth. He said the basic cause of all suffering is clinging, grasping, and fixation. And that thing that we cling to and grasp on can be an object, it can be a person, it can be a situation, it could even be an idea. Seeing how people argue politics so vociferously these days, Even ideas can be causes of grasping, clinging, and fixation for people. And so what we have to do is recognize that in that grasping and clinging, we are causing suffering. Just the feeling of grasping and clinging and squeezing of our fists closed on anything, whether it's literal or figurative, it causes pain. And as Pema Chodron, the great Buddhist teacher of the 20th century once said, if something hurts so much, it's because I'm holding on so tight. And so the thing that we cling to the most of all of these things is our sense of self, me or I. And so you could say that self-grasping and self-clinging is the root of all suffering. And therefore, the Buddha taught the third noble truth and the fourth noble truth as a way of showing us the way out of this suffering and its causes. He doesn't just want to relieve suffering. He wants to relieve suffering and its causes. And he wants to promote happiness and its causes. In the third noble truth, the Buddha said, if the cause of suffering is grasping and clinging, the solution is to let go. Learn how to let go and how to release grasping and clinging and fixation. But since we need a method, he taught the fourth noble truth, in which he said, do no harm, practice virtue, and tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. These four phrases, these four statements, are our framework for unraveling suffering. Do no harm. Don't hurt yourself. Don't hurt others. Practice virtue. Take care of yourself and benefit others. And tame the mind, which means to practice mindfulness and meditation. Because if we don't practice mindfulness and meditation, how will we know? How will we know that we are engaging in things that cause suffering or that we are engaging in things that bring happiness? How will we tell the difference if we are not mindful? And so the talk for today is based on that last one, mindfulness. Do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. It's based on that. Because the most important decision that we have to make in every moment is whether we are going to open up or close down. Are we going to accept or are we going to resist the world? Are we going to open up to the world or are we going to close up to the world? Are we going to open up to our potential or are we going to close? It's as though it's not quite as simple as a light switch. It's either on or off. But the most important, the decision that we have to make is, where are we going with our energy? Where are we going with our grasping and clinging? What will we take hold of and what will we let go of? And so this is where mindfulness comes in. Anybody who's learned how to meditate has learned something about this. And you will all recognize this. You've learned how to meditate and you're sitting in your meditation seat, right? You're sitting in your meditation seat and you are attempting to place your attention on the breath. The breath comes in and you're doing fine. And then the breath goes out and something happens. And you remember something. And you might be tempted in that moment to make the decision that you're going to follow that thought. Now, it could be something important. Did I leave the stove on? I get that. Or it could be minor, such as, this afternoon I have to buy bread. I mean, it can be something critical or something non-critical. But in that moment, whether we're thinking about buying bread or turning off the stove, our attention is diverted. It darts away from what we're doing. It darts away from our mindfulness, and it takes a walk. And sometimes it will take a walk for quite a while. I've had people tell me that that they have spent 5 minutes, 10 minutes working out problems at work when they were trying to meditate. And this is, I knew that you would all, I see heads nodding, so I knew you would all recognize this this experience of being really, really nicely attentive to the breath. And then something happens and you go elsewhere. But the second critical decision, if we miss the first critical decision of where are we placing our attention, are we placing our attention on the breath, or are we placing our attention on that lovely, lovely, beautiful, dazzling, shiny distraction that just arose? Where are we placing our attention is that first choice. And the second choice is, do I want to stay here? At some point, we may recognize that we are inattentive to the breath, or we're inattentive to our mantra, or we're inattentive to what we are reciting. And the moment we recognize that we're inattentive, we might then go into another distraction, which is bad meditator. I don't know. Have you ever practiced this one? The little slapping of the hand is a sound effect, but you get the idea. Bad meditator is the second story we can spin off into. We can say, oh, I am not getting this meditation thing. I just got distracted. Or we may think, I am never going to get this meditation thing because I just got distracted, so forth and so on. But the point is we have spun off into another story that, guess what, has as its root I or me. Is that a surprise? Okay. So what we need to do at that moment is make our second decision. The most important decision in that moment is, do I want to keep going with this? And hopefully, over time, we will slowly begin to make a different decision. Slowly, we will say, do no harm, practice for, okay, I'm going to do no harm. I'm going to return to the breath without punishment. I'm going to return to the breath with a sense of gentleness. I'm going to return to my breath with a sense of friendliness, being a friend to myself, and being an understanding person to myself. And by coming back with this gentleness, I'm going to retrain my habit so that I am not grasping onto either the thing I just got distracted about, or to the mistake of being distracted, or to the idea of mistake at all, or the idea of me at all. Me, I. So if we can gradually let go of all of these layers of grasping, then what's left is return to attention on the object of meditation. Because when we're attentive to that object, whether it's the breath or the mantra or a recitation, when we're attentive to that, then what we get from that is a moment of calm, because we are no longer contributing to suffering through grasping. We're no longer contributing to suffering through grasping, whether it's to ourselves, to a situation, to an idea. We have released the grasping, and we're at rest. This is why in Tibetan, the name for our basic form of quiet sitting meditation is shine, S-H-I-N-A-Y, shine. Shi means peace, and ne means abiding. So shine is peaceful abiding. And so that's what we're trying to train in when we do the practice. We're trying to train. We're not there yet. That's why they call it the practice of meditation and not the sudden instant perfection of meditation. It's called a practice for this reason. And so the most important decision that it trains us to make is the important decision that it has us make is, am I going to be a person who is nurturing peace and its causes, or nurturing suffering and its causes? So who am I going to be in this moment? Now, there's good news and bad news about this. The good news is when you train in it on your meditation seat, this training stays with you when you get up and walk around in your everyday life. You will actually find from time to time that you're in a situation. Maybe somebody has just said something to you that has hurt your feelings. Or maybe you have read something in the newspaper that's slightly upsetting. That happens these days. But you could watch yourself spin off into a distraction. This situation is terrible. That person is bad. Why did they hurt my feelings? Why do these crazy people do the things they do in this world? And you could be thinking all of these stories, which, as you can see, are the causes of grasping, clinging, and suffering. Or you could say, wait a minute, I don't have to keep doing this. I don't have to hold on to that hot rock that is burning my hand. I can actually let it go and relax my mind. And some people may say that that is not being and accepting what is, but I disagree. Just because you have let go of the hot rock that is burning your hand doesn't mean you're not going to deal with the rock. You will deal with that rock, but you will deal with it when your mind is more clear. You're not going to ignore the rock. It's still there and it's still hot, but you are going to work with it with a mind that is less engaged in clinging, fixation, and so forth, which causes us to make mistakes. The clinging and fixation can cause us to go into habitual patterns, some of which actually helped us in our youth, but are not necessarily helpful now. And being able to recognize that and to learn how to open that grasping fist and let go of that cause of suffering, good thing. So to back up again to the question of what is the most important decision that we have to make in any moment, it is that moment of, are we going to grasp or are we going to open? Are we going to close down or are we going to open up? And meditation allows us to do that briefly, maybe even fleetingly briefly, for just a few moments in the controlled atmosphere of our meditation seat. But then we get up and walk around. And when we get up and walk around, we may encounter these graspings and clingings in the wild, so to speak. And we have to be able to work with them. So we have to do, and we have to practice learning how to distance ourselves momentarily from what's going on, just momentarily. When I was a child, my grandmother had a temper. It happens. You know, a lot of people had grandmothers who were very, like, sweet. And, you know, they made cookies, you know, that kind of thing. My grandmother, she did bake cookies, but she also had this, she was very quick-tempered. She knew what she liked in this life. And when you weren't doing what she liked, she let you know. So, but she did teach me one thing that I really still use today. I would get frustrated about something when I would be staying with her for a day, one of my sick days from school or whatever, you know, take the child, park the child at the grandparents, there you go. So when I would get frustrated playing a game or doing something, she would say, count to 10. And what that meant was, take a moment. Give yourself a moment before you react. And at first I thought that was really kind of goofy. And I can't really say that I did it because I didn't really see the point. Why does counting to 10 before you open your mouth and say something, how does that work exactly? I'm a kid. I've got a voice and it's loud and I can make myself heard just like that. Why would I need to wait? But as I got older, I can see the grandmother wisdom in that. So if we can, as adults, take a moment in whatever way we need to take a moment, we don't have to literally sit there and count to 10, but what we could do is say something like count to 10 or say something like take a moment to ourselves. We don't have to say it out loud. Just take a moment. And in that moment, we take a breath. And then we pick up. Because that breath allows us to interrupt the flow of habitual energy that feeds our reactions. The flow of habitual energy that feeds our reactions. A lot of people say, I get mad real quick. Well, yeah. Because we're not used to impeding the flow of our habitual energy to react. We're not used to impeding the flow. But if we can do that, even for just a moment, this is fantastic. Of course, Buddhists, we're very lucky. We have a couple of other tools in our toolkit that are very useful for this. One of them is mantra. Most of you will have heard the famous mantra that every child in Tibet knows, Om Mani Padme Hum, or if you pronounce it with Tibetan pronunciation, Om Mani Padme Hum. All little children learn Om Mani Padme Hum. And in fact, their mothers recite it to them when they're in the womb. So it's a mantra with which they're quite familiar. Mm. And it can be a count to 10 mechanism. Even if you then fly off the handle and say stuff you don't want to say, if you have first tried to recite Om Mani Padme Hum to yourself just briefly, it's going to help. As my friend Eric Weinberg, who is, I think, with family today, would say, it wouldn't hurt. Actually, he pronounces it like his uncle. It wouldn't hurt. So the idea here is that it wouldn't hurt us to take a moment. It wouldn't hurt us to make a different decision. It wouldn't hurt us to think of something compassionate, even if it's just symbolically compassionate. Om Mani Padme Hum is a way of saying the name of Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Mani means jewel, and Padme means lotus. And in iconography, Chenrezig is depicted as holding a jewel, which is symbolic of our Buddha nature. Ding, we're reminded of our Buddha nature. Om Mani Padme is compassion. And so we're reminded of the jewel that is our Buddha nature and the path to get there, which is compassion. Even if it's just momentarily and almost like a nonsense word, Om Mani Padme Hum, it will help us to change and make a different decision. So we don't have to feel hopeless. This is very important. We don't have to feel hopeless because, again, another habitual thought we might have is, I'm never going to get this Dharma thing. I'm just going to keep making mistakes. But the fact of the matter is, even making that mistake can be a prompt. It can wake us up. It can be a prompt. If we think, oh, darn it, I just made another mistake. And then we say, wait a minute. Do I want to open up with this or do I want to close down? And then we say, Om Mani Padme Hum, or we say, take a moment, or we breathe. Then when we look at the situation again, we'll see, I don't have to be mean to myself in order to make a change. I can just make the change. I can just do something different with my energy. I can put it there instead of here. I can think, may my mistake stand for the mistakes of all beings. Because, you know, on this planet right now, somebody else just made a mistake. I don't know if that's something that will surprise you. When we make a mistake, we sometimes think we're the only one in the universe who has ever done it. Now, let's not be that selfish. We are not the only one who's ever made a mistake. There are lots of other people, and they're going through what we're going through right this minute. So what we do is we think about them, and we say, may my mistake stand in for all of their mistakes. May it symbolize all of their mistakes. In fact, may it become the receptacle for all their mistakes. It's almost like your little mistake becomes like a little tiny vacuum and then sucks up all of the mistakes in the world. And then you say, you know, by my doing this, may I be free of it. May all beings be free of it. And may we not make these mistakes again. And in that way, even a mistake can be the cause of cultivating mindfulness. It can be a cause of opening up rather than closing down. So this is the crux of what I wanted to talk about today. It is not easy to see the decision. It's not easy because our minds are so fast. And the stories we tell ourselves are so old and so habitual that we jump into them without even knowing. But if we continue to practice meditation at home, on our meditation seats, even if we meditate for just a small amount of time every day, that will sort of wind its way into our psyche so that we will awaken in the middle of the dream of that weird, habitual, negative thought we just had. A lot of people talk about Buddhahood as being awakening from the sleep of ignorance. A lot of people talk about enlightenment as though it were something really major, really big. And it is to the person who is experiencing it, But for the rest of us, it's a goal that we reach one moment at a time. And if we can wake up from the dream or the sleep of the ignorance of thinking we are a bad person, thinking that we are a person who will always make mistakes, thinking that we are a person who just can't get it together, if we can wake up from the ignorance, the sleep of ignorance of that thought just for a moment and say, I'm going to do something different. If we can do that, if we can wake up, which is good. That was actually auspicious. I'm not joking. It's kind of like that wakes you up. I love how the whole world can sometimes get into a Dharma talk. It's kind of good. In that moment, we're awakening from a habit that took us down the drain of selfishness and down the drain of ego fixation and down the drain of suffering. We were saved from it just by that moment of thinking, I'm going to do something different. And that thinking, even if it doesn't last long enough to totally fix the situation, even if it just changes our attitude for a few seconds, powerful stuff. Because it gives us a view of what is possible in the future. How would it be if our whole life was lived like this? How would it be if every time we found ourselves going down the drain of a habitual pattern, we could wake up right then? And making a mistake can actually allow you to do that. It's making the decision that I am going to wake up in this moment that is sometimes the hard thing. So you have to train in that decision too. Yeah, it's kind of a bummer. There's a lot of training in Buddhism. But this training will be easy. Why? Because it's so positive. Everybody loves love. Don't think there's a person I've ever met who doesn't love love. And I've never met a person who doesn't love the idea of compassion, even if doing it is a little hard. So love and compassion, they're good and fun to do, and we like them. And so what if, when you weren't meditating, what if, when you're just idly standing by, instead of looking at your phone, you could say, or you could actually put on your home screen, love and compassion. The word love and compassion. Whenever you're feeling like nervous or feeling at loose ends or whatever, a lot of people will look at their phones these days when they're feeling loose-ended. But what if you looked at that phone and it said to you, love and compassion, and you thought, may I accomplish love and compassion in this lifetime? That little tiny aspiration, may I accomplish love and compassion in this lifetime, powerful thing. Because it forms the basis of a new habit. It makes the decision process of open or close, open or close. It makes the decision easier because you have preloaded into that moment. You've preloaded your inner motivation, which is to wake up, to love, to wake up to compassion. May I awaken in every moment. You could put that on your cell phone. May I awaken to love and compassion in every moment of my life. And if you say that enough to yourself when you're just idly waiting in line somewhere, when you're feeling like people are looking at you and you don't like that feeling of people looking at you, if you suddenly think, may everybody who sees me be awakened at some point in the future to their Buddha nature. They may just see me and say to themselves, wow, what weird hair she has. Or they may look at you and say, I don't like the look of her face. But you're sitting there thinking, even if this person doesn't like me, may they be connected to Buddha. May they be connected to Dharma. May they be connected to Sangha and all that is good. So when we preload the bodhisattva motivation, that's what that motivation is. The motivation to be of benefit to everyone you meet. The motivation to liberate yourselves and others from the cycle of suffering. This, if you preload the bodhisattva vow into as much of your daily life as you can, that bodhisattva vow will make the decision easier. Open or closed? I'm a bodhisattva in training. Therefore, I may not want to choose open, but I'm going to try. Because you preloaded that attitude, that motivation. So this is what will make the decision easier, because you've already made the decision. You've already made the decision when you've taken the bodhisattva commitment to open in every moment. You've already made the decision. So it's not that hard. Yeah, it's hard because habit is really bad. Habit is so difficult to overcome. But because you've preloaded your attitude and your motivation, it should become easier. So I could talk a lot, but I think that it's maybe better to stop here with and summarize and then have a discussion. What do you think? And I by the way, I am tickled pink to see so many people home for Christmas. Let the record show, we've got several folks here who are home for Christmas, and so thank you for being here. And you're all right here. You're all right. So thank you. So before questions, I'll summarize briefly. The topic is the most important decision we have to make in every moment is that, are we going to be open or are we going to be closed down? And this is decided because grasping and clinging and fixation is said to be the cause of suffering. So we want to take hold not of suffering and its causes, but learn to let go, which is the cause of happiness. If grasping is the cause of suffering, then the cause of happiness is learning how to let go in any moment. And this actually may seem like a difficult decision because we have a lot of moments and we have a lot of habits that are grasping habits. And so how do we abandon grasping habits? We take a moment. We count to 10. We take a breath. We recite a mantra. We do something that distances ourselves from the habitual stories we tell ourselves. And in that moment, we make a different choice. We choose to be a loving, kind, and generous person to ourselves and to others, and set ourselves in a different direction in that moment. And so then lastly, by preloading, I don't know where I come up with these terms, but you know, it's 4 years of a journalism education? Anyway, you got a lot of words, you know, and you got to do something with them. You sort of preload this idea of the bodhisattva motivation wanting to liberate yourself and others. And by preloading that, then when the time to make a decision comes for you, it's easier. And so this is the entire practice of how to wake up in one little place. I've even explained what my teacher, Kempo Carter Rinpoche, told me about mistakes, which is mistakes can cause us to spin into a self-centered habitual negative pattern. But if we take that mistake and say, may I and all beings be free of mistakes and may we all become Buddhas in the future, that can help us to free us from the habitual story of failure and difficulty. So that's a short summary of the most important decision we have to make in every moment. And I don't want you all to feel nervous, like every moment is super important. Don't freak out. I had a friend tell me the phrase analysis paralysis, because if you get into analysis paralysis, you can't make a step. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about trying to open up and trying to think of love and compassion toward ourselves and others. And so don't freak out. Don't think that every moment is critically important, although it is. Did I say that? Anyway, but the reason every moment is important is that at any moment we could actually be open to the possibility of awakening. And wouldn't it be lovely if at a very important moment for us, such as the moment when we're ill or the moment when we're passing away or something like that, that we could then have an open thought for the whole world in that moment? Wouldn't that be wonderful? And be able to release and let go in that moment. So learning how to do it moment after moment after moment after moment, even if we only do it for 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 moments a day. We all know there are thousands of moments in a day. But if we can even just purify and master a few of them, awesome. So, okay, questions. We have maybe 15 minutes. We can spend doing questions. Question microphone is open. Feel free to line up if you need to stretch. You can, and we have a customer right away. Hello there.
Very satisfied customer.
Oh, very good. Yes, yes, yes. Very good, very good. Dharma is like really cool. Yeah, he's got it. You have to get close to the mic is the problem. Yeah.
Let me think. First of all, just to comment on this. I remember some years ago, I had a real problem with my temper. I remember one time I slammed a car door so hard I shattered the window.
Ooh.
I was really ticked off. It was wintertime, and I the lock was frozen, and I had to be somewhere.
Oh,
I remember talking to a friend who's a yoga teacher, and they just said to me, you know, you learn how to pause, because one of the elements in yoga is recognized is emptiness. And it is in emptiness that we find the information we need to be. And that's always stuck with me.
Wow. Yeah, in that open moment.
Right.
In that open moment, that's where the information comes to you. Because when you're closed down and grasping, it doesn't come.
Right.
Because all the energy is like bottled.
Right.
Yeah, that's cool.
So
what
I think
a great
your
thing.
Grandmother and I have something in common there, maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I got
but,
it.
But which is great grist for the mill, mud for the lotus to grow in. But for me right now, and you were talking about pausing, and I think I may, in some regards, have the opposite issue. I pause too long. And, you know, there's fight, flight, and freeze. And I have this great emanation of Vajrayogini presenting themselves to me. It's my boss. And she's, like, if you threw a bucket of water on her, she'd be, like, you know, 100 pounds wet.
Okay.
And this woman has a temper. Like, she's, the like, wrathful. She loves to scream and yell at me. And I shut down.
Yeah.
Like, I can't speak. And so I guess what I'm presenting to you here is, like, you know, what would be, you know, when we're talking about this being in the moment, making that decision.
Yeah.
When in a moment when I need to, where I feel like compelled to speak up.
Right.
And I, like, lose my voice. I'm just, like, sitting there.
I hear that.
I mean, I could get into the specifics of the brain chemistry but I'm just like, and there are times when I just want to say, you know what? I really don't like being spoken to that way. And I'm going to go sit down while you chill out and then we can talk later.
I hear that.
Handle it in the most loving way I can. But I don't know if you have anything as far as Dharma practice.
That's
what I've been thinking about lately. It's like, wow, here's this person who's been presenting my life to point something out to me.
I get it.
Yeah.
I have spoken to other Tibetan teachers about this sort of thing, because it's no surprise this is not the first time this kind of question comes up. Because I think what it is that, as one person said to me once, there are a lot of people who are hurting out there.
Right.
And I mean, so you can start there.
Right.
And in your own mind, not to her, but in your own mind say, who hurt you?
Right.
Who hurt you?
Right.
And if that helps, do that. Another method you could use in the moment when she's yelling is to imagine that you're an open window and she's shouting through you in her pain and agony.
That was actually one of the first things I thought about.
Yeah.
And I couldn't remember where it came from, but
yeah,
I remember.
Yeah, yeah. I got that from a friend of mine from the recovery tradition.
Right.
That's not a Buddhist teaching, but it came from the recovery tradition. And another thing would be to imagine that you're Chenrezig, and you have a body that's made of white light shining, and that it absorbs all of the anger. And that your form as Chenrezig becomes really bright. So the idea is that her anger is actually feeding your symbolic compassion.
Right.
Because when we imagine ourselves as Chenrezig, it's kind of a little bit of a habitual. You know, we're trying to habituate ourselves to an idea of having Buddha nature, an idea we're not used to. So we might think it's a little fake.
Right.
But it's okay. It's better than being fake the other way. Fake toward opening is better than being fake toward grasping, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And so those are three things that I can think of immediately, thinking about who hurt her that made her like this.
Right.
Because she hasn't gotten through it.
No, she hasn't.
And then second, to also another way to accept her pain is to see that you're an open window and she's shouting through you. And a third way is to imagine that you're a Chenrezig made of light and that her anger is making your color brighter. Yet another way is to use Tonglen and to imagine that you accept her pain. Mm-hmm. That's not as easy for some people. So those are all things you can do in the moment when she's angry. But I almost feel you have to wait until you see what kind of relationship she has, because a lot of people don't like for their subordinates to point out their faults. Mm-hmm. So she might not be open to that. But you can always look at it from a collegial point of view when she's not angry. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, I've noticed something. I just want to see what you think of this. See what you think of this. Mm-hmm. When you yell like that, it really causes my habitual tendencies and I shut down completely. Would it be all right if I started just saying a word to you like, not now, or I need a moment, and then come back to you when we're both calmer?
Right.
And that way you would make a deal with her to say, this is hard for me. Mm-hmm. And I understand that you want things done a certain way, and I will do my best to give you things done the way you want them. Mm-hmm. But the yelling, it just makes me shut down, and I'm not effective.
Right.
So can you help me by allowing me to disengage and then come back when we're better?
Right. Oh.
And if she doesn't allow that, then you might have to look for a different place to work. But right. You know what
I'm
saying?
I'm already, so hey.
Yeah, okay. No, I get it. No, I
need somebody.
Yeah, he's a highly skilled guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd been visualizing her as Vajra Yogini.
And that's actually another thing you can do, yes.
Yeah.
And that she's saying the mantra. There's two like clarifying mantras. Mm-hmm. One is Hung, H-U-N-G.
Right.
And the other is Pet.
Right.
P-H-A-T, Pet.
Right.
And that both of those are said to be clarifying, like she is dispelling your obstacles.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you can do that.
Getting beyond the mundane.
But not everybody can do that when somebody's yelling.
I didn't say it was easy, but
okay, all right.
I've gotten a little.
Well, so there's a fifth way. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for bringing this. I'm so sorry that you have to go through that. I had a person who didn't yell but was really emotionally manipulative as my boss for a short period of time and way in the past, and it was really really hard for me.
Right on.
Yeah, I was when I was working at the newspaper.
Right on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And there, pay no attention to that woman behind the curtain. She's Vajra Yogini. Thought I'd stay with the theme there. I mean, we all have Buddha nature, and in Kagyu tradition, when you visualize your Buddha nature as a being, you can visualize it as any being, but when you're doing Mahamudra, you visualize it as Vajra Yogini. Yes. Hi. How are we doing on time? We're doing good. Okay.
Oh, good. I've seen, I'm here to ask for some clarification of something
you
said.
Sure.
But I have seen some progress in my moment of decision.
Cool.
But the issue that I have, and I suppose others probably do too, and I think you were hinting at this, or at least I heard it being hinted at, maybe you were saying it more explicitly, is getting to the point of decision.
Yeah.
Recognizing that I have gone off onto some
sidetrack.
Distraction. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think you said that the moment of decision will come more easily through your intention to function this way.
Mm-hmm.
But could you talk a little bit more about getting recognize while you're in that distraction, recognizing that you're in the distraction so that you can get to the point of making a decision about whether or not to leave that.
To remain there, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate that question. I think part of it is going to I feel like there's three factors in that. There's three major factors in that making of a decision. Okay, I think there's three. One is developing mindfulness, just basically developing mindfulness to notice when you have become distracted, okay? Or in the case of this, when you've been consumed by that habitual reaction, you know, noticing when you've been consumed by it. And that really can only come from doing meditation practice and watching your breath and then gently bringing your attention back over and over and over again, so that noticing and coming back and noticing and returning becomes your new normal, your new habit. So part of it is experiential and is practice related, and you just have to practice and then the experience will come up for you. But then the others are attitudinal. One is to understand the teachings, which is do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. So recognizing the harm that is done by fixation, recognizing the harm that's done by fixating, you want to let go. You form the wish. You get the framework of wanting to let go. And understanding that letting go brings the causes of happiness, you want to strengthen that. So that's also a little bit front-loaded in that you have to hear the teachings and really trust them. At first, we don't really trust them, but as time goes along, we can trust the teachings that letting go brings happiness and grasping brings suffering. So that's one part. And then the last part really is this love and compassion, this bodhisattva wish, the wish that all beings experience freedom, the wish that all beings experience love, compassion, and wisdom, and taking that bodhisattva commitment within yourself. So that's three factors that make the decision easier. Number one, that mindfulness, so that you can see the decision. To me, there is no other way to see that decision point than to practice quiet sitting meditation, whether we call it shamatha or shine or whatever term we use for it, that tranquility. Actually practicing it, noticing and returning, that's going to give you the wherewithal to do it. But then the two parts, the two other factors, one of which is knowing that grasping brings suffering and letting go brings happiness, making a firm commitment to yourself, I'm going to try to learn how to let go, and I'm going to try to learn how to let go of grasping. And then lastly, the bodhisattva motivation. There's no quick tip that will make it fast, except to remember that you have that decision. Am I going to open up or am I going to close down? Which is it going to be? And to just make the resolution that you're going to do better every day and every day and every day. That's, you know, and never giving up. That's a fourth factor, never giving up. Just never give up. There's no reason to give up. In fact, there's every reason to keep going. So hopefully that'll help. Yeah. There's a teaching in Pema Chodron's book, Start Where You Are, which is taken from the book, The Great Path of Awakening. She calls it practice the three difficult things. And she summarizes them as see what you do, do something different, and make that the way you live your life. See what you do means recognize that your reactions are not always helpful. See what you do. See what you tend to do when things happen, when things go wrong, what your habit is. See what you do. Second is do something different, which is make a different choice. Open up in some way, whether it's through visualization, mantra, taking a moment, counting to 10, whatever it is. And then make that the way you live your life is the third one, which really is never give up. Say, I'm always going to do this. This is going to be my job from now for the rest of my life, is I'm going to keep opening and keep opening and keep opening like that. You make that determination. And it's called practice the three difficult points. And in Jonggun Kantrol's book, he said, at first, it is difficult to recognize disturbing emotions. We're so used to buying into them. Then it is difficult to overcome them with the remedies that we just described. In the end, it is difficult to cut their continuity, meaning they just keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. That's why it says, see what you do, do something different, and make that the way you live your life. So hopefully that'll help. Thank you. There's time for one more, so you've got it. Yeah, sorry about the... Yeah, there you go. Just get close to the mic.
So thank you very much, Kathy. This is really brilliant, and I'll make a note of the title so I can recommend it to people online.
Okay, sure.
And so I just wanted to add that a practical way to spread that message that you just said right now is you often see people, and the part about practicing compassion for yourself instead of self-hatred, and accepting your mistakes and realizing you have a choice and you can be different and keeping that faith, mm-hmm. is when you see people, especially children, hitting themselves in the head and saying, stupid, stupid,
oh,
stupid, and they think that's acceptable.
Yeah.
So I worked as a substitute teacher, and whenever I saw children doing that, I'd say, no, you are not allowed to hit or name call in school, and that includes yourself, because you're mm-hmm. making your body sad mm-hmm. and making yourself sad, and that's not acceptable. But you see adults doing it too, and when they do it, it creates a negative mm-hmm. Home or a negative workplace, mm-hmm. and then it increases the habits of other people. If you see someone doing that a lot, you start doing it too,
mm-hmm.
and then it's just, you know.
It just keeps going.
Mm-hmm. A way to, you know, to enter, it's a way to effectively spread that message by saying, no, that's negative, and you're not allowed to name call or
mm-hmm.
hit.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate this, because I have to tell you that what happens in that moment, I don't know exactly what happens for the young person in that moment when they hit like that. I don't know what happens for them, but I think it's like a release of the tension and the pain. And it's like a momentary release of that. And what's very interesting is that when the Tibetans teach Mahamudra meditation, they say that in the moment of pain, physical pain, you can actually look at your mind in that, because your mind is very concentrated in that moment and you can see its emptiness. But that kind of teaching doesn't work for children. Doesn't work. They can't shock themselves and then see their mind's nature. They don't have that kind of training or thinking. So at first we have to teach compassion, 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 compassion. And I think that teaching that rule of not hitting and not name calling is brilliant. So thank you for doing that, and keep doing it. And my hope is that all of us, when we see that, we'll be able, whether it's children or adults, we'll be able to say, you know, it's time. It's time to change this. It may have helped you release that moment of pain when you were young, but you don't have to do it anymore. It's not necessary anymore. You now have more tools at your disposal to release those feelings. Now you have different ways to release them. You don't have to use those old ways anymore. And what's good about that is that for many people, this will help them see a new way of being. And so I thank you. And I hope that that all of you this week, because for many people, we are in the middle of the Christmas holidays here. So you'll be seeing people you're not used to seeing, members of your family and so forth. And it's my hope that as you're seeing all of these people, some of whom are causes of joy for you and some of whom not so much, that you will hold a thought for their pain and their suffering and make the aspiration that seeing you is at least a momentary relief for them, and that you make the aspiration that seeing you, they will awaken to their own nature, if not now, in the future. Let's sit quietly for a moment and dedicate the goodness of our session today. We dedicate the merit and goodness of this session to all suffering beings. We make the aspiration that all beings everywhere are freed from suffering, come to Buddhahood, and then, coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We dedicate the goodness mentally with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Wow, what a wonderful group. I'm so happy. Look, because did you notice it's like people kept coming in, so it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. You guys are amazing.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling, or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.